Our Torah portion this year, as we heard Rabbi Bernstein, is the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. We read part of it last week. We read more of it today. We had a midrash about it last night. And when people think about that particular tale, they often wonder about Abraham negotiating with God. How many innocent people does it take to save a city? Or the portion we talked about today that we're going to study at 1 o'clock. Why was Lot's wife turned into a pillar of salt? Well, there's another part of the story that is equally, and if not more, disturbing. And we're going to talk about it today. So I see some children in the room, so I want to forewarn the parents. We're going to be talking about some difficult things that are in the Torah. Because this is the Torah. These are the stories our ancestors wrote. This other part that's more disturbing is when male visitors came to visit Lot at his home. And the townsmen then came and surrounded the home. And it says in the text that they said, the townsmen, "We want to be intimate with them." So rather than sending out his guests, the men, Lot said, "I beg you, my friends, do not commit such a wrong. Look, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them as you please, but do nothing to these men, since they have come under the shelter of my roof." That's in that Torah. That's in every Bible. To justify such a repugnant response, rabbinic commentators explain that Lot was being a model host who was honoring the hospitality code. So in other words, Lot was willing to sacrifice his wife or his daughters for the sake of the male guests. And considering Lot is one of the good guys, he was saved from the destruction, it makes one wonder, what were the authors' values who wrote this particular tale? But in reality, it wasn't just the authors of this story that we need to wonder about. For I would argue they were reflecting the misogyny of their age. And regrettably, the mistreatment of women found in this particular story of Sodom and Gomorrah is found throughout the entire Bible. Women were second-class citizens or worse in that world. And regrettably, this ancient view did not remain part of the past. Rather than being rejected as a terrible legacy, a stain that should have been eradicated, the second-class status of women continued and continues throughout history. This overt and blatant sexism has formed the foundation of how women have been mistreated through Western culture and Western civilization through the centuries. The fight for women's rights have been hard fought, a struggle that we don't have time to examine yet today fully. Suffice it to say that women's rights have been a long time in coming, the efforts were hard fought, and even though progress has been made, there are still struggles. In other parts of the world and here in the States, there's still inequities in pay and in opportunities. And this year, we witnessed a severe blow to women's rights when the Supreme Court reversed 50 years of American history with the Dobbs decision. This decision marks the first time in history that the Supreme Court has taken away a fundamental right. It took from women their right to bodily autonomy. The line from Sodom and Gomorrah, where a father was willing to allow his daughters to be victimized for the sake of the men, to the Supreme Court denying a woman's control over her own body from the moment a sperm is implanted in an egg, it's inevitable. The reasoning in both are the same. Women have less rights than men. They have less rights than a zygote or a fetus. The message is clear from biblical times to the present. Women come second. It's been centuries between the writing of the biblical legend of Sodom and Gomorrah and the recent Supreme Court decision, but that reasoning is the same. Control over women of their bodies is determined not by the women themselves, but by those in power. The implications of the Supreme Court ruling and how it gives rights, states rights to impose cruel and devastating restrictions that women are now in jeopardy are overwhelming. And it's not fully understand the implications of this ruling. We've already seen in Ohio a 10-year-old who was raped who had to leave to get an abortion. There are now other cases that are being discovered that other girls are forced to do the same thing. There are now pharmacies that are denying women certain medications for diseases like arthritis because those medications could be used to induce an abortion, and they want to make sure that's not how it's being used. There's discussions now taking place among physicians about treatment options for pregnant women who have cancer or have an ectopic pregnancy for fear that the treatment could, quote, harm the fetus, resulting in abortion. The Supreme Court ruling meant that from the moment an egg is fertilized by the sperm, that potential life is equal to and in conflict with the needs of the woman. Justice Brett Kavanaugh acknowledged that when he said in his opinion, the problem is you can't accommodate both interests, meaning that of the woman and that of the fetus. And he said, you have to pick. Now, it doesn't take a legal scholar, a political pundit, or a religious scholar to know, based upon the treatment of women throughout history, that women's rights and their interests will be ignored, while from the moment of conception, the fertilized egg will be deferred to. The Supreme Court ruling and the resulting personhood bills, which claims that a fetus has the same rights as any person, places the woman who is pregnant in a complex and at times adversarial relationship with the fetus. And if this goes unchecked, we are only seeing the beginning of the problems that it will cause. And while the Dobbs ruling has had a devastating consequences for women, Justice Clarence Thomas, in his support of the decision, suggested that other established rights be reexamined. The right of same-sex couples to marry, the right to contraception for anyone, including married couples. And there is reason to assume that his desire to re-examine these rights is that he hopes that they're reversed. For what other reason would there be to re-examine them? And for those who claim reversing those rights is impossible, I would suggest you only look at what happened to Roe. It was reversed, supported by several of the judges who, in their confirmation hearings, claimed that they would not reverse established law. But they did. The forces that want to turn back the clock are strong and well-financed, and they are on the march. This Supreme Court ruling was more than about abortion rights. This Supreme Court ruling was a religious doctrine in the guise of law. It was inspired by and in concert with the push that we are seeing in America to erode the separation of church and state, a fundamental principle on which our nation was founded. The Supreme Court ruling used a particular religious definition of when life begins. Other religions, including Judaism, do not claim that life begins at conception. But that's beside the point. No religious definition of when life begins should be the basis for the law. For the question of when life begins is a multifaceted one, which can be understood in different perspectives. But ultimately, we must remember that the question of when life begins really is about when is the entity granted the same legal rights as an adult human being? Or as it seems, granting the fetus more rights than the woman herself. Understand that there are those whose agenda is to impose their religious values upon our nation. Focus today, rightly so, is on Christian nationalism. That's that specious claim that America was founded as a Christian nation. We currently have at least one member of Congress who proudly proclaims, "I am a Christian nationalist," and a gubernatorial candidate who stated that America is a Christian nation and separation of church and state is a myth. Be clear that this belief is not held by most Christians. And as Catherine Stewart, who spoke here, the author who wrote The Power Worshippers, observes, this is more of a political position than a religious one. It's a position that most Christians don't hold. In fact, there is an organization that you should know about called Christians Against Christian Nationalism. They state on their website, and I've talked to some of the executive director, "Christian nationalism seeks to merge Christian and American identities, distorting both the Christian faith and America's constitutional democracy." But even before Christian nationalism was identified, there have been forces that sought to erode the separation of church and state. And they've been working for a long time, and they've been working hard. Remember Jerry Falwell? Minister, started the Moral Majority, began Liberty University, started a legal school, a law school, that now trains lawyers. Falwell said clearly, the idea that religion and politics don't mix was invented by the devil to keep Christians from running their own country. He started a law school. That law school exists, it's training lawyers now, and it says, "We do this to equip future leaders in law with a superior legal education and fidelity to the Christian faith expressed through the Holy Scriptures." Be clear, it's how Falwell wanted those things understood. And he's not the only one working to train lawyers to see the world through a very particularistic, narrow Christian lens. There is the Blackstone Legal Fellowship. It's a summer program to show students how God can use them as judges, law professors, and practicing attorneys to help keep the door open for the spread of the gospels in America. I want to say it again. Both of these organizations have a very narrow understanding of what is Christianity and how it is understood by them. But no, it's not just people trying to reshape the law. There are those who want to reshape public education as well, trying to change how civics is taught, how we teach history, particularly the separation of church and state. And while we don't talk about it as much as we used to do, there are those who want to undermine science education in America, putting creationism in schools under the guise of something else. And textbooks have been changed. They have been altered as a consequence, biology textbooks, where the idea of evolution is separated from the rest of the education so a biology teacher could teach biology and never mention evolution. We should see what is happening not as silos. It's not just abortion, anti-science, LGBTQ rights, contraception, public schools. What we need to see that this is a concerted effort trying to change the very nature of America. Ralph Reed, remember him? He's not gone away. He worked with Jerry Falwell. He's still out there and he's still working. And he said just recently, last election cycle, "Let's go out and do it in the glory of God and make sure that Christians are the head, not the tail, and the top, not the bottom of our political system." Be clear, Reed, like Falwell and the others, have a very narrow interpretation of Christianity that most Christians don't accept. I want to keep saying that. You need to hear that notion. And regrettably, there are members of the Jewish community who are embracing this as well. For they too have a narrow interpretation of personal autonomy and personal choice. These are folks who want to impose their religious beliefs, but more than their beliefs, they want to impose their rules, their constraints, their limits on everyone. They have to seek political and judicial ways to do so because they're incapable of convincing people that they're right. So when persuasion fails, these groups turn to the political process to restrict the rights of everyone. What we are seeing is not only a well-organized and well-financed group seeking to impose their rights, we are watching an attack on separation of church and state. It is a fundamental American right upon which our nation was founded. President Ronald Reagan said at Hillel Temple in New York in 1984, "We establish no religion in this country. We command no worship. We mandate no belief, nor will we ever. Church and state are and must always remain separate." I hesitate to think what Ronald Reagan would be saying and wondering what's going on in the nation that he led today. President George Washington, in 1790, reached out to the Jewish community in Newport, assuring us, the Jewish community, that we had a place in this nation, that we would live here free and equal citizens. And he concluded with a biblical allusion where he said, "Sit in safety under his own fig tree, and there shall be none to be make him afraid." He said we didn't need to be afraid. I'm sorry to say, I think we need to be afraid. I think we need to worry. We must be concerned when a sitting member of Congress, a different member of Congress, said, "I'm tired of the separation of church and state junk." That's not in the Constitution. It's easy to dismiss a few fringe members of Congress, say, "Oh, they don't represent anything." But recent surveys are finding that close to half of Americans are at the very least supportive of the fusion of Christianity and American civic life. There are Americans who believe that Christianity should influence our public policies and national identities. As Michael Flynn, former general, said, "If we're going to have one nation under God, we must have to have one religion." One nation under God, he said, and one religion under God. What Flynn and the others are doing is not just attacking separation of church and state. They're attacking America and what it is and what it stands for. America was the first secular nation in the history of the world. It began not with a pledge to a monarch who was appointed by God, not to fidelity to a divine being. We built our nation on we the people. People, not God, not a monarch, not a self-appointed prophet, but on people. And when the separation of church and state is challenged, the right of people to make their own decisions, independent of religious intrusion, is being challenged. The Jewish community, like all religious minorities and those who hold no religious affiliation, should not only be appalled. We should be on the front lines defending separation of church and state and what it means to have a democracy. When religious autocrats try to impose their rules, they're in direct conflict with democracy of the people. We, the Jewish community, found a home here in America. It was the first modern nation where we could be full and equal citizens. To not appreciate this moment is myopic. Not only do we have a responsibility to protect it now, we have a responsibility to future generations so that they can live full and equal lives as well. Misogyny, homophobia, anti-scientific thinking is wrong, even when those speaking such noxious ideas claim divine revelation. I know it's hard to challenge religious thought, and I know that there are those who have tried to wrap their political ideas in religious thought, thus making it even harder to discuss. But now, at this moment in our nation's history, we have no choice but to talk about it. And we do so not from a partisan perspective, but from a perspective of a community that has benefited from the sacred idea of separation of church and state, and a nation not founded on religion, but on we, the people. Some may wish to debate whether or not this is the worst time in American history. It doesn't matter, for this is our moment in history. This is our time to act. And the choices we make today will be the legacy we leave for tomorrow.